Welcome to the Public Radio Hour, a weekly mix of podcast and handmade radio features. This week, we shine the spotlight on planetary radio as it revisits the 1878 solar eclipse and the struggles of early women scientists.
As hard as it is to be a female scientist today, you multiply that by 1,000. And in fact, you know, there was a real obvious societal bias against women going into science, and Mariah Mitchell would have none of it.
As part of an interview series on end-of-life issues, we'll get some advice on creating a peaceful end-of-life experience from Huntsville Hospital's Dr. Monica Williams-Murphy.
When someone knows they're dying, there's an emotional window of opportunity that opens. It's really unlike any other time of living.
And we're taking your questions on end-of-life challenges that you may be facing on the WLRH Facebook and Twitter pages. You can also find links at WLRH.org/Public Radio Hour. Here we go, starting with this news update. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our new weekly mix of podcasts and handmade radio features. One thing we hope you enjoy about this new show is it's interactive. You can share your thoughts, ask questions, and find useful resources about our current featured topic, end-of-life challenges, at WLRH.org and on the WLRH Facebook and Twitter pages. We're also recruiting volunteer producers to help produce the show, like Kathy Main, who's been touring local farmers markets for a new series titled The Markets Open. Let's meet some farmers at the Green Street and Latham Farmers Markets.
Markets open! You may sell!
My name is Peyton Sandlin. I'm with Sandlin Farms. Me and my husband run this operation in Holly Pond, Alabama, which is in Coleman County. We farmed peaches down in Chilton County, and me and my husband met at a farmer's market. We were married in 2014, and so I just kind of moved from one farm to the other, and now I help my husband farm in Coleman County. It's so nice to be able to walk out and say, I think we're going to have squash or tomatoes tonight. I'll be right back. Let me go get it out of the back field and then come up and cook it. I mean, that is fresh right there. And it's just so nice to be able to learn his grandmother's canning recipes and put up for ourselves. So it's something I get a privilege of doing that no one, I bet, my age has the privilege of doing.
What is the best part of your day?
The best part of my day is knowing that I've accomplished what I needed to accomplish that day and just resting, because it's tough, a two-man operation, doing everything that needs to be done, you know, farming even just 3 acres. It might not seem much, but I'm telling us, it wears both of us out at the end of the day. We're ready to be done.
How are y'all today?
Maryland Champion and Champion Farms. And we're in Falkville, Alabama.
Our biggest thing is we do strawberries. We have a U-picket, and we do a lot of tomatoes, but we don't have a U-picket on the tomatoes. But we do a lot of tomatoes, squash, cucumbers, zucchini.
Is this a family farm, or did you choose to do this?
This is a family farm. It started out with my mother.
Is she still with us? Bless your heart. Well, this is a great testament that you loved what she did, and that you're doing it too.
She wouldn't have it no other way. She started doing this. A guy that we lived next to had a farm, and he liked growing this stuff, and he didn't have anywhere to sell it. So my mother started peddling it on the back of her truck 30 years ago. She started it out, and it just kind of grew from there. And so,
that is such a great legacy. Do you have your children that are also farming for you?
No, ma'am. They went on to other careers. They didn't want to be farmers because they know this is very hard work.
But they grew up eating the bounty.
Yes, they still do. They love eating it. They just didn't like farming it. They didn't like picking. I tell you, the best part of the day is when I get to meet new people, talk with people, and see their faces when they buy our produce and they enjoy going home with it, and then they come back and tell us we really enjoyed what we cooked. That's what we really like to hear, is when they tell us about our produce, about how they really enjoyed it.
My name is Jesse Murphy. I'm owner-operator of DSR Farms. We are from Danville, Alabama, in the west side of Morgan County. This is our fourth year farming, coming up on our fourth year. We produce pasture-raised, non-GMO, drug-free chickens, rabbits, quail, and pork. Yes, ma'am, quail. We raise a jumbo Coturnix quail. They're a white breast meat. They're a fast-growing bird. They're very economical for us, and they're very delicious. We got started farming really by accident. We had a couple of chickens as a hobby. We wanted some fresh eggs. I had a friend that called me that had a bunch of chickens to give away, and we done a little research, watched a few YouTube videos, and it blew up from there. And so far, we haven't hit a plateau yet. It's getting bigger, faster, stronger, and we're making more money and being able to expand more. So far in 4 years, I haven't actually made any money that I've put in my pocket. Everything that we make, we turn back into the farm. We're getting some equipment now that make things a lot easier on us. We bought a tractor this year. We're hoping to purchase land next year, so it's doing really well.
What's the best part of your day?
When I sit down in my recliner. That's really, when I get home from my work, I also work full-time. I work maintenance for a steel mill. And when I get home from work and get the little few chores we got going on knocked out, and I get to sit down with my children and talk about their day and my day and eat supper.
That was Jesse Murphy, Marilyn Champion, and Peyton Sandlin, three of the wonderful farmers you can find at our local farmers markets. The Green Street Market is open Thursdays from 4 to 8 p.m. And Latham Farmers Market at Latham United Methodist Church is open Tuesdays from 3 to 6. The Latham Market is closed for July 4th but reopens for Senior Day on July 11th. This is The Markets Open. If you'd like for us to visit your market, contact us at WLRH.org, where you can also find this feature. My name is Kathy Main, and we'll see you next time.
Up next on the Public Radio Hour, it's Planetary Radio. Stay tuned for an update on the latest targets for the Mars rover and get a history lesson on the 1878 solar eclipse and the impact it had on a young Thomas Edison and early women scientists. We'll also ponder the cosmic history of our calcium with Earth Date. Be sure to keep sharing those comments and questions on end-of-life issues or anything else on the WLRH Facebook and Twitter pages. Later, we'll get some advice from Huntsville Hospital's Dr. Monica Williams-Murphy on how to create a peaceful dying experience for you and your loved ones as this Public Radio Hour continues on 89.3 Huntsville.
Thomas Edison, Eclipse Chaser, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. A lot to share with you this week as we explore the great North American eclipse. Not the one coming in August, the one that enticed American scientists and that famous inventor to the Wild West of 1878. David Baron tells the tale in his terrific new book, American Eclipse. We'll visit Russia, China, Europe, and the UK with Bill Nye. There's space news from each of those. And when Bruce Batch joins us, we will unveil the brand new Planetary Radio t-shirt that one of you will win in the Space Trivia Contest. Does it get any better? Why, yes, it does, because here is Planetary Society Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, you had much to report, as always, in your June 13 update on the Curiosity mission, Mars Science Laboratory. They can be found at planetary.org, of course. We are headed toward Vera Rubin Ridge. I love the renaming of that ridge, formerly Hematite Ridge, after the great astronomer who just passed away in December. Why is this such an exciting target for Curiosity?
Hematite Ridge, now known as Vera Rubin Ridge by the team. I do want to mention that that's not a formal name. It's just an informal one that the team refers to landmarks by. It is one of the features that was visible from space as seen by a spectrometer and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to show signs of water-related minerals in the rocks. Now, Curiosity has actually passed by and even drilled into many rocks that have shown signs of being affected by liquid water, either forming in liquid water or having groundwater percolate through them later. But this is going to be the first one that was obvious from space. So it's going to be exciting to drive up onto the ridge and sample it, because they do have to get up to the top of it in order to test and see what kinds of water-related minerals are there. But what they're really excited to do is get beyond it to this area behind the ridge where there are clay-type minerals that should be some really interesting geochemistry.
And I guess the mission slogan at the moment, and really for the foreseeable future, is up or upward.
Absolutely. In fact, the mission has really been driving upward ever since beginning to cross the dunes. It's really going to be fairly monotonic, going up in elevation, which means also up through Mars's history.
As always, you've included lots of terrific images. One that is particularly striking, that same team, the Curiosity team, has called unofficially Dyke Peak. And you describe its geology as weird, but weird geometry. And I know what you mean looking at it.
It's really hard when you first look at this thing to decipher. You are looking at a rock that seems to have like two intersecting bedding planes. And what we're actually looking at is a place where the rock fractured underground and minerals filled veins. And then now that the rock is above ground and being eroded, the veins are more resistant to erosion than the rest of the rock. And all of it is getting wind blasted in this incredibly dry environment. So you have these ridiculous thin blades of rock that just... they really should not be there. You want to walk up to them and just tap it, and you expect the whole rock to fall apart. But these kinds of cool wind-eroded rocks have been around since Curiosity landed, but this is a particularly fine example.
Yeah, I think of them as terraces for tiny Martians. The mission is not trouble-free. The problems with the drill continue. Any progress there?
Unfortunately, no progress to report. The problem is a particular part of the drill feed mechanism. And in order for the rover to drill, the drill has to feed forward. And right now, they can't get that mechanism to work. And the drill is stuck up behind its stabilizers. They can't even get the drill in contact with rock. And it's such an intermittent and frustrating problem that it's just been really difficult to troubleshoot. They are making some progress in understanding the problem, but they aren't any closer to a solution if they're going to get to one.
Well, let's hope that they find either a solution or some alternative, especially with all that great geology ahead. That's Emily Lakdawalla. She is the senior editor at the Planetary Society. On now to the boss, the CEO, Bill Nye. Bill, there is almost, maybe actually, too much in the Tuesday edition of Space News First Up for us to be able to cover today. So let's jump in. I mean, there is just a lot going on up there off the surface of the Earth and down here getting ready to leave it.
Absolutely. You guys, the great dream that we've all held since the Cold War is for the United States, European Space Agency, ESA, and Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, to work together. Wouldn't that be great? So there's a proposal to build a cislunar station. Who am I, Matt? I'm open-minded, man. But these things are very difficult to pull off. It's politics on top of politics mixed in with politics.
But we do have the head of Roscosmos saying that he expects to collaborate, to cooperate with NASA and ESA. I mean, that's...
It would be a wonderful thing. It would be world-changing. It would be great to not have each... space agencies being responsible for the whole mission. You could spread the cost out and everybody would be able to do more.
Am I being too naive or idealistic to think that if we can cooperate up there, we can cooperate down here?
Yes.
All right. How about China then, which is not saying it's going to collaborate on this, buying ancient technology for a Soviet-era human lunar lander?
So you guys, if you go to the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., second most popular museum in the world after the Louvre, you can see the Soviet-era spacesuits, airlocks, and hardware that they were going to use to go to the moon. It doesn't look different from the stuff that that NASA built, that the U.S. built, because I guess you're solving the same physics problems. I remember the boots had – you could see the stitching of the leather soles. Which sounds like, well, you couldn't use leather soles. Why not? If they're sealed up well enough, it would work fine. So I'm all for it. But what it indicates is that the Chinese Space Administration intends to send people to the moon. And I think that's cool. It will inspire humankind the same way that the original guys did.
Almost lastly, a British startup that claims it's going to be launching CubeSats into space for about a tenth of what it's been costing.
Bring it on. You can do the rocket equation, so-called, where you take the natural log of the final mass divided by the initial mass. Okay. And it's big fun. And it looks like you could build a rocket, pick a number, 5 meters tall, two tall people tall, and send individual or two or three CubeSats into space. It seems like a cool thing to be able to do. And I am all for it, man. That would talk about democratizing space. And maybe we could fly LightSail 7 or something on that. It would just be fantastic.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Matt.
That's the CEO of the Planetary Society and the host of, I mean, who else? Bill Nye Saves the World, coming back soon to a Netflix box near you. We're going to go on now to a really great conversation about the eclipse of 1878 and people who chased it, like Thomas Edison. I used to listen to David Barron's Great Science Reporting on National Public Radio. I didn't know during those years that he had an obsession. Like so many others who have witnessed a total solar eclipse, David's heart had been captured by a moon shadow, and he was already planning to tell a story that would bring more readers under the spell. That book is now out, just in time for the Great American Eclipse of 2017, when the path of totality will cross much of the United States. Yet it's about an eclipse of 139 years ago. David recently joined me via Skype while he was in the midst of a book tour. David, it is an honor to welcome you to Planetary Radio to talk about this book, which I absolutely love, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. Welcome.
Thank you, Matt. I'm thrilled to be here.
It really is just that. I mean, it's not just eclipse chasers like yourself, though I guess you prefer the term umbrophile. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But this Win the Glory of the World, that's kind of key to the book. I mean, how did the rest of the world, especially Western Europe, view the status of American science leading up to this big event in 1878?
That's a great point you bring up. So, you know, when I started looking into the eclipse of 1878 and just decided this is a fascinating kind of adventure tale from the American West and the Gilded Age that I wanted to write about, I just started out thinking about it as a story. But the deeper I got into it, the more I realized it's symbolic of America's early rise as a scientific nation. Because as you say, back in 1878, when America had just turned 100 years old, we were basically an adolescent nation. We were becoming an industrial power, but Europe really looked down on us intellectually. We were not thought to be very deep as a country. Europe was where culture came from. Europe was where good literature and art and music and science came from. But there was a small band of American scientists at that time who were determined to show that this democratic nation on the other side of the Atlantic could do science. And so here in 1878, a total eclipse was crossing the Wild West at a time when total eclipses were very important to science. And this was America's chance to prove itself on the global stage in terms of science.
And I would say they did. I mean, wouldn't you say they were successful?
Looking back at the eclipse of 1878 from our modern standpoint, you really can't say that there were any specific discoveries made during that eclipse that held up over time. But from a societal standpoint, what it meant for America getting its infrastructure of science together and becoming a country that cared about science, that's where I think the real significance of the eclipse of 1878 shows up. When I started writing the book, I wasn't thinking about illustrations, but as I was doing research, I just kept coming across these just beautiful etchings and line drawings and, you know, in some cases, sketches and paintings from that era. You know, this was the late 1800s was a great time for illustrations when there were a lot of illustrated newspapers and magazines. And I started collecting these things. And when I was putting the manuscript together, I started to put them in and I wanted to see what my what my editor thought and friends who were reading the manuscript, and everyone loved the illustrations. So I just kept putting more and more in. And I specifically, even though this was an era when photography existed, of course, photography was not very good. And I use very few photographs because I actually think that the etchings and the drawings just really bring alive the era much, much more so than the photographs.
I could not agree more, but I will note that you have this series of very fine color plates in the back of the book where those source notes are. Did this book get underway at that shrine to knowledge, the Library of Congress in Washington, or is that just where you spent an awful lot of your time?
Well, all right, to back up just a minute. I had the idea for this book 19 years ago. I've been planning this book since 1998, which is when I saw my first total solar eclipse and just became hooked. That's when I became an eclipse chaser. And as a science writer, and that's what I've done as my profession all my adult life, I decided in 1998 that I wanted to write a book about eclipse chasing. But I knew in 1998 that the time to come out with the book would be the summer of 2017, because this is when people will care. So I put the project on hold for a while, and about 6 years ago, I started to really look around to find a good tale. I think that the best way to educate is through stories. I wanted to find a really good story that would enable me to teach people about what makes eclipses so fascinating and what made them so important to science. So I started to look around, and it didn't take long to discover that really the best eclipse stories come from the 19th century, because that was a time when total eclipses were not just amazing natural spectacles, but they were really important to science. The European nations and the United States during that time would send these expeditions off to various parts of the world to sit in the path of totality, wait for the moon's shadow, and frantically conduct studies in 2 or 3 minutes to try to discover what they could about particularly the sun. I started to look at various eclipses in the 19th century. 1868, that eclipse crossed India and Siam. 1870, that one went across the Mediterranean. And then I came to 1878, and I just really saw how rich it was in terms of characters and setting. And I soon discovered that a lot of the scientists who were in the West for the eclipse of 1878, their papers still exist, and many of them left their papers to the Library of Congress. And when I went there and opened these boxes and found original letters and telegrams and train tickets and diary entries, it just all came alive.
David Barron, author of American Eclipse. He'll tell more tales that mix astronomy and the Wild West after the break.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, how our appetites are influenced by plate color, glass shapes, and even the sound of a beer being poured. It's the latest in gastronomy science, or gastrophysics. Plus, what if getting your flu vaccine was as easy as slapping on a Band-Aid? It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Tune in Science Friday, Fridays at 1 on this channel, with a repeat Friday nights at 9 on 89.3 HD3. You're tuned to the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 FM HD1 in Huntsville. Back to Planetary Radio in a moment, followed by a discussion about the importance of celebrating life and the end of life. But what happens to us after life? And where did all this stuff our bodies are made of come from? Big questions pondered next on Earth Date.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Take a moment to look at your hands. Move them around and watch how the bones work. Think about what your hands have done in your lifetime alone. They learned to write. They drove your first car. Took the hand of the person you'd marry. They work every day in an office, shop, or laboratory. And they held or will hold your children for the very first time. Your hands will touch every part of your time on Earth, but the minerals that make them up are eternal. The calcium in the bones of your hands is older than the Earth itself. It formed after the Big Bang through supernova explosions and became concentrated in rocky planets. Once on Earth, it may have spent 500 million years drifting in seawater or passing through generations of ancient sea creatures. 200 million years more in the age of dinosaurs, making up the bones of tyrannosaurs or the eggshells of pteranodons. Your calcium then journeyed through 100 million years of mammals, finally pausing for a geologic split second to form your hands. After your hands have held their last cup of coffee or played their last song, no matter how your remains are disposed of, your calcium will one day re-enter the earth. Who knows where it might end up next? Perhaps it could pass through the bones of generations of future humans, one of whom just may take a tiny part of you once again to another galaxy. I'm Scott Tinker, and thanks for listening.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. EarthDate is researched by Julie Hennings, written by Harry Lynch, and distributed by Mark Blunt and Casey Walker. For more stories, follow us on Facebook or visit earthdate.org.
This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. David Barron has written American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. After reading the book, I told David I could imagine it as an adventurous graphic novel full of colorful characters. He agreed, but there's nothing fictional in his tale about the adventures of astronomers who ventured into the still wild American West back in 1878. There's much more of our conversation online at planetary.org/radio. Thomas Edison was an eclipse chaser, at least for this one occurrence.
Right. And so, again, when I get back to what really got me engaged in the eclipse of 1878, a big part of what got me hooked early on was when I learned that Thomas Edison was in the Wild West in 1878 to see a total solar eclipse. And this was a key year for Thomas Edison. He had just come out with the phonograph, and that's what launched him from being a very successful but little-known inventor. In fact, perhaps his best-known invention up to then was something called the electric pen, which was basically a mimeograph device. But suddenly he comes out with the phonograph. He becomes a global celebrity. He heads off to Wyoming to conduct an experiment during the eclipse of 1878. He comes home, and the very next day he begins work on the electric light bulb. So this is a key year for Thomas Edison. And he, of course, was such a fascinating character. I mean, not only a genius but at invention, but he was a genius at public relations and just a really colorful character who was being interviewed by journalists all along his way out to Wyoming and back. And I had such great fun getting to know him.
Yeah, you really paint a great picture of him, and I wondered whether he was a better self-marketer or a better or inventor. It was kind of a toss-up, I think. They went hand in hand. At the other end of the spectrum is my favorite character in the book. That was this astronomer, Mariah Mitchell, who fought against tremendous odds brought about by, well, her fellow Americans to be able to get out and enjoy and do science at this eclipse. Talk a little bit about her, because she's just an amazing character in American history.
Yeah, I just love Mariah Mitchell, too. So Mariah Mitchell was an astronomer, and she was by far the best-known female scientist in America in the 19th century. She first came to prominence in 1847 when she was working professionally as a librarian by day, but was studying the heavens at night while living on the island of Nantucket, Massachusetts. So she discovered a comet in 1847, and for that she received a gold medal from the King of Denmark, and that kind of launched her to fame. By 1878, she was teaching astronomy at Vassar College, the, at that point, new all-women's college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And as you can imagine, this was a time, I mean, as hard as it is to be a female scientist today, you multiply that by 1,000. There were so few opportunities for women to actually work in science. And in fact, you know, there was a real societal, an obvious societal bias against women going into science. And Mariah Mitchell would have none of it. And she not only did her own scientific studies, but she saw it as her personal responsibility to pave the way for the next generation of women to come along. And she was out there publicly advocating for women to go into science. And in 1878, when dozens of men were assembling eclipse expeditions out to the West and receiving support, financial support, logistical support from the federal government to put these expeditions together, she was left out. But she would not accept that. And so she, on her own, put together an all-female eclipse expedition out to Colorado, to Denver, which was a scientific expedition, but it was really a lot more than that. It was a kind of political theater. It was an effort to show America what women could do in science and to wake them up. And there was a lot of press coverage of her really quite praising her for what she was doing, and people realizing that women could be smart and educated and healthy and feminine and do science.
A glorious book. I recommend it very highly. Thank you for coming on Planetary Radio to talk with us about it. And best of luck as you continue to travel the country. I hear you're in what, Springfield, you said? Springfield, Missouri?
You've caught me in Springfield, Missouri, which is just outside the path of totality. But, of course, the path does go across Missouri. And I was in St. Louis the other day and near Carbondale, Illinois. Tomorrow I'm going to be in Kansas City. Those are all in the path of totality. And excitement is really building, as well it should be. Folks who live in the path of totality, they have to understand that they have been given a gift to not have to go anywhere and to see the grandest sight in all of nature.
We've been talking with David Barron, and he is the author, the creator of American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. It is published by Live Right Publishing. That's a division of W.W. Norton. It's available in all the usual places, and we'll put a link up to it on this week's show page that you can get to from planetary.org/radio. Proudly calls himself an umbrophile. I guess you better explain that. Basically, you're an eclipse chaser, but an umbrophile?
That's just a fancy word using Greek and Latin, lover of the shadow. But yes, I do more than anything love to stand in the shadow of the moon.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, and he's our expert on the night sky and all the other stuff that he brings us in this segment. Welcome back. We are going to give away the new Planetary Radio t-shirt.
Ooh, exciting.
It is. It really is. I love this shirt. I don't have one yet. It's that new, but it's going to be part of our grand prize package.
Actually, we've talked about it and decided you're not allowed to have one. I'm sorry to be the bearer.
What? I quit. I'm out of here. Tell us about the night sky. I'm leaving.
Okay. I guess we'll have to find a new editor. So we've got Jupiter in the evening sty. It's out with the pigs. So we've got Jupiter high up in the evening sky up in the south. And if you look to its 10 degrees to the left of it, there's a bright star that's noticeably bluer. That is the star Spica. We've also got Saturn rising in the east in the early evening and setting around dawn, looking yellowish. And we've got Venus dominating the pre-dawn sky in the east. We move on to this week in space history. It was 20 years ago that the NEAR spacecraft, later renamed NEAR Shoemaker, flew by the asteroid Matilda on the way to the asteroid Eros, which it would eventually orbit and even land on.
Kind of a rendezvous, right?
Yes, yes, yes. But 20 years ago, it was just a flyby of the asteroid Matilda giving us another look at another asteroid.
Scary how long we've been at this stuff.
You mean us personally?
Or? Yeah, yeah, you and me.
yeah, that's what I thought. All right, we move on to random space fact.
How melodious.
About 80% of the Venusian surface, Venus's surface, is covered by smooth volcanic plains. But there are two highlands that are sometimes called continents that make up the rest of the surface area. One's in the northern hemisphere, one just south of the equator.
That's the place to build the hotel so you get the view.
Exactly. And if, you know, oceans ever fill in the searing hot climate, you'll have an ocean view.
Oceans.
I actually own some property there, Matt.
Do
which
you?
I'd be happy to sell to you for a reasonable price.
Oh, let's talk.
All right. Afterwards, we'll talk.
Oceans of molten lead.
Beautiful. Be so shiny.
I love those waves. Surf's up.
All right, we move on to the trivia contest. I ask you what class or group of meteorites matches the average composition of samples returned from the asteroid Itokawa by the Japanese Hayabusa mission. How'd we do, Matt?
you intimidated people with this. And it wasn't that hard. We had a whole bunch of people who came up with it, including the person who I think is our winner and a first-time winner at that, William Lee Calvey of Martinez, Georgia. He said the answer was low total iron, low metal chondrites, otherwise known as LL chondrites.
Yes, it's also going to be my rapper name.
LL chondrites. Yeah.
Yes, LL chondrite is just one particular version of what are called ordinary chondrites. They make up the majority. They're kind of rocky things that make up the majority of the meteorite population.
Well, congratulations, William. You are the latest winner of a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. You may be, who knows, the last winner of the second-generation planetary radio T-shirt. And we threw in a planetary radio sticker.
Those old T-shirts are going to really go up in value.
I know, especially the ones that we sign. That's what our winner had to say. But we got our usual collection of funny responses from, people like Erica O'Day. He says, I love this asteroid. Looks like someone left it out in the rain. I know what he means.
Yeah, it's got a weird surface texture.
Martin Hajoski in Houston, Texas. He says, like its Earthbound namesake, L.L. Bean, L.L. chondrite might possibly be well known in the main asteroid belt someday as a purveyor of fine, stony wash jeans.
In the main asteroid belt?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Main with an E?
No.
L.L. Bean, never mind.
Nice try. But you're right. That is where they're based, isn't it? Finally, this from Perry Metzger in New York. My favorite group of asteroids remains the polyisoprene, or rubber asteroids.
Yeah, they have very similar-sized meteorites that pervade our existence.
All right, we're ready to move on.
I talked to you about Venus's surface. You might have seen it coming. What are the names of Venus's two large highlands areas, sometimes called continents? What are their names? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have got until Wednesday, June 28 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. You might be the very first person to win the gorgeous new Planetary Radio T-shirt, which comes to us from Chop Shop. Thomas Romer runs this place. We've done stuff with them in the past, posters, and now there is an entire Planetary Society store at chopshopstore.com, which is how you can get there. We'll put the direct link up on the show page at planetary.org/radio, but it's Chop Shop. The Planetary Society T-shirt is, if anything, I hate to admit it, even more gorgeous than the Planetary Radio T-shirt. And there's some other cool stuff there. Yeah, you can buy a Planetary Radio T-shirt now for the first time ever.
That's totally cool. Hey, everybody go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what shirts would look like named after other letters besides T. Thank you, and good night.
I get it. You mean like J-shirts or...
Yeah, U-shirts.
Or B-shirts.
B-shirts,
X-shirts.
Yeah, I think there's a whole new trend that we could start here.
I like it. We're going into business, you and me. That's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science, Technology, and Product Merchandising for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here on What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its adventurous members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.
We hope you enjoyed Planetary Radio and Earth Date. Tune in next week for more. If you'd like to suggest a podcast for us to feature, hit us up on Facebook or Twitter or at WLRH.org. For tonight's final segment, we begin an interview series that examines something we all encounter. How do we face the end of life for ourselves and for others? There are challenges and pitfalls for your own health and as you try to care for family and friends. But Jenny Kennedy found some answers from Dr. Monica Williams-Murphy, Medical Director for Huntsville Hospital's Advanced Care Planning and End-of-Life Education Programs. Dr. Williams-Murphy says more Americans should be talking about how we can improve the quality of life for the dying and for those who survive them.
the vast majority of Americans, the vast majority of people who roll into the emergency department are completely unprepared for the end of life, although there's 100% mortality for all of us. Mm-hmm. And it's simply because doctors don't bring it up and we're not comfortable talking about it in our families. So this is the product of this reticence to have the conversation common in our culture, in our homes, across the dinner table, and with people that we love.
When you first contacted me about this interview, I thought, of all the people on the staff here at WLRH, I'm the person who probably needs this the most. I'm not atypical. I'm working hard. I have an elderly parent and I have a teenage son. So I kind of feel like I'm in the balance. So here I'm dealing with my elderly mother and I also have a son that I want to communicate with. Where do you even start? Let's start with mama. What should I be doing now to make my mother's eventual transition easier for her and for me and for everyone in the
Perfect.
Family?
Well, you are what we call the sandwich generation, the person who's attempting to balance caretaking roles for a younger dependent and an older dependent. If we are fortunate enough to live to middle age and we have parents who are alive, we become parents to our parents. And that's nothing that anyone's ever prepared us for. This conversation needs to come from the healthcare providers, and I hold physicians responsible, so I take that responsibility to myself. I should be able to see your mother in a visit to the office or a visit to the emergency department and see you and ask you both on the table and openly, do you have a plan in place? And what are the next steps? And what does this medical moment mean in the larger picture? Where are you in the map of life? So here you are, and so the question is, what do you need to do today? The most important thing you should have organized for your mom is an advanced care plan or an advanced health care directive, which would include her choices of who would make a decision for her if she is unable to speak for herself. If you are the person that she has selected to be her health care agent, if she hasn't had a detailed discussion with you about what the meaning of life is for her, what her thoughts are about whether she believes in an afterlife, what is suffering, what is acceptable, what would she be willing to bear the burden of medical treatment for, to be alive for, what does quality of life mean for her, what things does she want to be able to do? So having this conversation now, having it written, and knowing deeply what your mother wants and does not want is the most meaningful and powerful thing you can do now to prevent suffering later and to give absolute peace to both of you. Because that is possible, but it takes open conversation and planning in advance. It doesn't happen by accident in our culture.
And in terms of getting it in writing, do you have to, is it a document that you need to file with a court or something you can just write down on a sticky note? I mean, sort of form does it need to take?
Well, you can see an attorney, which is costly, and they can write down some details outside of what is generically available. If you see your primary care doctor now, or you go to any local hospital and ask for an advance directive, you will be given one freely. You can also look up online Alabama Advance Directive for Healthcare. It'll generally take you to the Alabama Bar Association or the Alabama Hospital Association for a very short download. And there's some basic questions that it asks you, including if you are in the state of a terminal illness or actively dying, or you enter a state of a chronic vegetative state where you're permanently unconscious. What would you want or not want in these situations? And then it gives you a space to select at least two people who would speak for you, a healthcare proxy, if you can't speak for yourself. So these documents are free. You do need witnesses who are not also your healthcare proxies, but someone who's not a blood relative witness to make that valid. And then your family needs to have a copy. Your healthcare proxies need to have a copy. The hospital needs to have a copy. Any physician that you ever see needs to have a copy. One lady told me even her mailman had a copy. So whatever it takes.
Uh-huh. That's good practical advice there.
Yes.
Now, on the other hand, I also have a teenage son. And I had a fairly significant health scare a couple of years ago, and I didn't even know what to say to him. I remember driving past Maple Hill Cemetery and saying, we have a plot there. I think I'd like to be cremated. Maybe you can put my urn there. But that's as far as it got. How do we communicate with our children?
What I've found is that actually people younger than 30 in the United States right now are actually more open to talk about death and dying than the rest of us. And so I think that your son might welcome a conversation about this more than your mother might.
Absolutely.
Actually,
yes.
And of course, we live in a high-tech generation. A quick and easy way to make your healthcare wishes known and can be kept by a younger generation person is that you can use your smartphone or you can use your computer and you can make a video of yourself.
Okay.
And you can say, "Dear loved one, you know, I really want to be cremated, and this is a beautiful urn I've picked out, and or I want to be buried here, and at the end of my life, please don't put me on a machine. I want to be at home under hospice conditions with classical music, classical music playing in the background with cats at my feet." And you can send that to them, and there you go. You know, the younger generation likes that, so I would make a... That would be my recommendation.
That seems so much easier. Now all of us have the opportunity to plan for death. What happens if it catches us off guard?
Okay, so this is the vast majority of the patients I care for, people who are completely unprepared for death and dying. From a personal perspective, you may not get what you want at the end of life. Far too many people receive unwanted heroic measures that they wouldn't have wanted, but no one ever asked them, and we didn't have anything documented to the contrary. And there are unfortunate times where we actually extend the dying process because medicine's very aggressive. And I say it's like we pull you into the medical train and the train keeps on going. And so unless there's something in place to say, no, I don't want this level of aggressive care anymore. I want to focus on comfort. The default of the system is to do everything. And at the end of a long life or terminal illness, everything may be dying in the intensive care unit with needles and beeping monitors and alarms. You may be strapped down. You may be sedated. Now, this is not the way that I want to die. So from a personal perspective, you may get something you don't want, or you may not get what you do want. You know, maybe you want a feeding tube and your family doesn't know. How do they support your healthcare wishes if they haven't talked about it? And so there's suffering that can go on across the board by avoiding the conversation. And I certainly don't want to focus on suffering because I'd like to tell you about what you can get if you have this conversation. Mm-hmm. So let's try to imagine that we have planned and we can put all that aside and say that's not our pathway. The end of life can become a time of peace, closure, growth, healing, unlike any other time of living. Because in the sure face of coming death, when someone knows they're dying, there's an emotional window of opportunity that opens. It's really unlike any other time of living. And it can't be replicated at any other time. And this is the time where we work out our stuff. We say, "Please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you. Goodbye." Make a legacy. Write the story of your life. Wisdom emerges from what we do that's heroic and stupid. You know, and so these are powerful stories. It's a powerful time of living. But those treasures can only be obtained if you enter that space consciously and accept where you are in the map of life. If you remain in denial, that opportunity does not open as wide for you, and your family misses the opportunity to have closure with you and to allow this to be peaceful rather than chaotic. So there's a gift that we can obtain if we can talk about it now. And that gift is beautiful, and I see it on occasion. And that's what I want for all of your listeners. That's what I want for you and your mom. And that's what I want for my family as well.
So what resources can you recommend to help people get started in this conversation?
Well, thank you. I actually have a website, oktodie.com. That's www.oktodie.com. And so it's filled with checklists and resources if you are making a decision for yourself or another. You may contact your primary care providers. Actually, physicians as of January 2016 now receive some reimbursement for having advanced care planning conversations with you.
That's good to know.
Yeah. We're still a little timid about doing it because, frankly, most of us get very little training about how to have or how to open this very sensitive conversation. But your doctor, in other words, is ready and willing and able to sit down with you and to start having a map of life conversation and to sort of map out the future and focus on how to prepare for peace. Those are the two main resources I'll offer you immediately. But when you go to your hospital and they ask you if you have an advanced care plan, if you say no, they'll hand you one immediately. Also, I'd like to mention the Conversation Starter Kit. And if you can look up the conversationproject.org online, there's a lovely little 8-page, it could be online or printed out, document that lovingly and gently leads us in to a conversation with our families, because frequently, of course, people don't want to talk about it.
So why do we need to talk about end-of-life issues? I think you've gone over that, but is there anything else, the big overarching reason for us being here and having this discussion?
Well, the end of life is just as important as the beginning of life. But in our culture, we've lost touch with that. And my very own grandmother taught me this firsthand. Unfortunately, I showed up to talk to her about her healthcare wishes on the day that she died. And I did not see it coming. I'm a healthcare provider. How did I miss that? I have no idea. But I showed up in time to ask her her wishes. She did die in the hospital because we were not prepared to support her in dying at home. And I got to hold her hand and say, thank you, I love you, and goodbye. And it was one of the most beautiful and powerful moments of my life. And it transformed me. It made me a different person. And I developed a level of gratitude for my grandmother that I had never had before. And what I'm saying is the end of life and moments of death and dying can be some of the most transformative for us personally. Moments become more important. Each sunset is more important. Each touch of a grandchild's hand is more important. And so seeing that we're mortal, embracing our mortality, and even saying, let's celebrate this, can actually change our daily lives.
That was Jenny Kennedy speaking with Dr. Monica Williams-Murphy, Medical Director of Huntsville Hospital's End of Life Education Programs. Dr. Williams-Murphy is also author of It's Okay to Die, based on her experiences as an emergency room physician. From the eternal calcium in our bones, thanks for tuning in this first episode of the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. Also, thanks to everyone who's commented on the WLRH Facebook and Twitter pages and at WLRH.org. Find resources about your end-of-life planning questions at WLRH.org/Public Radio Hour. And be sure to share any comments you have. This program is built weekly by WLRH staff and volunteers. Thanks for listening.